The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our program for over 10 years. You can reach them at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return one more time to the November 2019 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month has been the Smokies. We're going to start out, as we always do, the last reading of the month with the current decade theme that they have. 1950s, the decade in motion. Our State's look at the people and events that shaped the 50s continues with an art museum for all. The Art of the Impossible. North Carolina's investment in a public art collection opens minds, enriches the lives of citizens, and creates a home for the state's cultural aspirations. Written as always by Philip Gerard. On the day after Christmas 1951, a self-made millionaire and art collector from New York, Carl W. Hamilton, knocks on the door of a stranger's home in Southern California. He bears two suitcases heavy with photographs of 200 paintings chosen for purchase by the North Carolina State Art Commission. Five men appointed by Governor W. Scott Kerr at the core of a public collection for a state-owned museum in Raleigh. The stranger is Wilhelm Reinhold Valentiner, a German-born American art historian and collector. He's the director consultant of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and soon to play the same role at the Getty Museum in Malibu. Valentiner is considered the preeminent art museum director of his generation, perhaps of the 20th century. Hamilton is seeking his expert opinion should the commission spend $1 million on the paintings. Valentiner, or perhaps it's pronounced Valentiner, is 71 years old, near the end of a long and distinguished career that began at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. He knows North Carolina's reputation as a tobacco producer, but Raleigh certainly was not known as an arts center. He later writes, "I was amazed to learn that the state of North Carolina had appropriated $1 million, not for a museum building, as is usually the start of a museum in American cities, but for the acquisition of a collection of paintings of old masters." Valentiner approves of most of the paintings on the list, impressed that a group of four amateurs and one art historian has compiled such a strong catalog. Those 157 paintings by Dutch, Flemish, French, Italian, German, Spanish, British, and American artists become the germ of a permanent collection designed to cover the breadth of artistic achievement in the Western tradition. Valentiner faults the commission for not including works of modern artists, not even impressionists, considered heinous by the state attorney general. The collection is conservative, non-controversial, and heavily Eurocentric. But Valentiner is right to marvel at the state appropriation. It's the first time any state has ever funded a public art collection. The idea for a state art museum dates at least to 1924, when the Fine Arts Society formed with the goal of making inspiring art accessible to all citizens. 3 years later, incorporated as the North Carolina State Art Society under its first president, John F. Blair, the group began staging art programs and small temporary exhibits in spaces provided under charter with the state government. Through a magazine article, The Art Society attracted the interest of an elderly, wealthy businessman from Cabarrus County, then living in New York, Robert Fullenwilder Pfeiffer. Keen to find a home for his art collection, Pfeiffer wrote to his friend Blair, who had arranged an exhibit at the 1927 State Fair. The next year, Pfeiffer passed away, bequeathing 75 paintings of varying worth to the Art Society. In his final weeks, he wrote, "I feel now that any pictures I may leave to the Art Society would be properly shown." Moreover, the terms of his will named the Art Society as a potential beneficiary of an estate trust worth more than $1 million. Eventually, the entire trust, along with significant interest, does revert to the Art Society, creating a permanent endowment for the purchase of artworks. In 1943, pursuing an energetic progressive agenda even in the middle of war, Governor J. Melville Broughton established the Citizens Committee for a State Art Gallery, appointing as its head Robert Lee Humber, a hard-charging international lawyer and art connoisseur from Greenville. Humber took on the challenge and proved adept at the politics of fundraising, telling legislators that he had secured $1 million in pledges from an anonymous donor and calling on them to match it. On April 4, 1947, with one day left in the legislative session, State Representative John Kerr Jr. of Warren County championed the appropriations bill, declaring, "Mr. Speaker, I know that I'm facing a hostile audience, but man cannot live by bread alone. Here's to his colleagues to do the far-sighted, statesmanlike thing without being afraid." The bill passed the House by 3 votes before passing in the Senate. Humber's pledge was a verbal agreement with Samuel H. Kress, the five-and-dime magnate who'd used his fortune to acquire one of the world's most important collections of Italian Renaissance artwork. But by the time the bill passed, Kress was too ill to manage his own affairs. With no record of the promise, the Kress Foundation, which was planning to distribute his vast collection to 18 museums across the U.S., proposed an alternative offering Raleigh $1 million worth of exquisite art. The state money buys such works as the Armorer's Shop, circa 1640 to 1645, a rare composite painting. Flemish painter David Teniers, the younger, is credited with a smoky gray ambiance of the workshop where bent figures in red shirts labor over dark blades, while a small section in the foreground attributed to John Bruegel, the younger, features a pile of armor rendered in such fine detail that it seems to have a steely weight and texture. With funds from the Pfeiffer bequest, the commissioners purchased St. Jerome and his study, circa 1440, attributed to the German master Stefan Lochner, the saint who famously translated the Bible from Hebrew and Greek into Latin, is shown robed in red, leaning away from his reading book, or rather reading desk. The Kress Foundation furnishes 71 paintings and sculptures, including such work as Young Man with a Sword, circa 1633 to 45, by the Circle of Rembrandt van Rijn. The gem of the collection, the Peruzzi Altarpiece, circa 1310 to 1315, of Giotto di Bondone and his associates, comes from the Kress Foundation in 1960 by way of the National Gallery, which reputedly declines to accept the piece in its entirety. The altarpiece is composed of 5 steepled panels painted with tempera and gold leaf, depicting Christ in the middle, his mother Mary to his right, and 3 other saints, St. John the Evangelist, St. John the Baptist, and St. Francis of Assisi. Its importance lies partly in the work itself, a rare complete Giotto altarpiece that survives, and the only one outside of Europe. But it's also the work of Giotto, an artist whose fame extended well beyond his lifetime and whose work influenced the Renaissance painters who came after him. He revolutionized the flat Byzantine style of the day, presenting his figures in a more human 3-dimensional style with recognizable facial expressions and signature gestures. In 1955, the commission persuades Valentiner to come out of retirement and head the North Carolina Museum of Art, and he proves to be an inspired and inspiring choice. Though in poor health, partially deaf, divorced, and living alone, he immediately and energetically sets a professional tone for the museum. With little social life, the museum is Valentiner's whole focus, the thing that keeps him going. "You ask me whether I'm happy in Raleigh," he writes to his former assistant at the Getty, Mary Adams. "The working conditions are better than in Los Angeles, but there is little fun in this provincial town where no restaurant or even drugstore is open after 9, and the only bookstore with a few decent books is at the museum." Valentiner himself writes the catalog for the NCMA collection, founds a journal of art history, publishes prolifically in other scholarly journals, and remains tirelessly in his devotion to art. He seems energized by the prospect of building a world-class gallery from scratch in a most unlikely place. He writes, "It is one of the pleasures of life to work oneself up again and again." He curates loan exhibitions, enlarging the experience of the museum and attracting patrons for repeat visits to see the newest works. Almost immediately, he begins cultivating out-of-state donors and seeking new additions to the permanent collections during his summer trips to Europe, where he acquires Egyptian, Greek, and Roman art, along with textiles and sculptures. Hamilton and Umber remain active as board members and advisors, and Valentiner often finds them vexing, at times exasperating. Both are strong, opinionated personalities. Humber, in particular, is used to being in charge. At one point, Valentiner writes a letter threatening to resign, but he neither mails it nor throws it away. The North Carolina Museum of Art finds a temporary home in the musty old Highway Division building on Morgan Street. The plain columns inside are sheathed in black marble. The drab walls are hung with tapestries, and the entrance has a limestone classical portal added to it. Governor Luther Hodges cuts the ribbon on opening day, April 6, 1956, and as imperfect as the physical museum is, the public loves it. For the city of Raleigh, NCMA is a point of civic pride. For others, it is a declaration that art matters and that an appreciation of beauty makes better citizens. Generations of schoolchildren grow up gazing at the old masters, dreaming of making their own art. Newspapers call it the miracle on Morgan Street. Whatever his differences with Umber and Hamilton, Valentiner recognizes their achievement. He writes in his unpublished memoirs, "This is the story of the creation of the Raleigh State Museum, which turned out to be a popular success. It is mostly due to the initial work of the two personalities, Hamilton and Humber. The extraordinary part is that they together produced a fine museum with an excellent collection, though they knew very little about art." He adds enigmatically that other personal motivations played a much greater part in their work than love of art. At last, the unflagging work of art lovers, business people, politicians, and volunteers over the course of decades, channeled and focused by the premier museum director of the day, has achieved a seemingly impossible dream. The great art of the world now has a lasting home in North Carolina. A little bit of a sidebar here. It says plates and palettes. In 1983, NCMA moved out of the downtown and into a brand new building on the western edge of Raleigh. True to form, museum leaders had chosen a site that would be welcoming to visitors with plenty of parking and room for an outdoor art park. Now at 164 acres, the country's largest. To make North Carolinians feel even more at home among the art, Chef Stephen Wallawender prepares meals in the bright and airy Iris restaurant, named for the museum benefactor Iris Cantor. Along one wall, out of the box, a swirling stick sculpture by local artist Patrick Doherty echoes the museum's mission to share beautiful artwork indoors and out. If you'd like to visit NCMA, they are at 2110 Blue Ridge Road. Call to make a reservation at Iris You call 919-664-6838. Use lunch as an excuse to visit the museum. You are listening to our state magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. We're about halfway through. Oh, here's a picture of a young lady with a pith helmet on and a smoke canister in her hand, which says, I'll bet she's got some bees that she's going to make sleepy before she sticks her hand in their home. The caption says, in 2010, a love of bees inspired Alice Hinman to found Apiopolis. Maybe that's not how it's pronounced, but we'll go with that for now. Apiopolis, a nonprofit urban bee sanctuary in Raleigh, whose mission is to improve the health and habitat of pollinators. Keep calm and buzz on. There's smoke filling the spaces among trees, in backyards, between homes. It tumbles over the eaves of big buildings. No need for alarm, not here. The smoke is for our honeybees. Written by Eleanor Spicer Rice. Alice Hinman has a simple toolkit to tend her honeybee hives. She uses a hive tool, a crowbar shorter than your forearm, to pry open hive lids and separate frames. She wears a hat and carries a veil in case she needs to shroud her face from the hive's curious or angry citizens. She has a brush to gently herd fuzzy ladies around combs and frames to keep them safe from being squished and out of the way for honey harvest. And she has a smoker, a tin of tinder stoked by bellows. Hinman puffs smoke into a hive's entrance to say, I'm here, don't worry. Before she lifts the hive's lid, she pushes more small smoke gusts over the frames to tell the bees, please stay calm, it's only me. Hinman, a beekeeper in Raleigh, has spent most of the past decade tending dozens of hives across the city, on the roofs of downtown buildings like City Restaurant, in residential backyards, and tucked into community gardens. As Hinman quietly pumps her smoker, the soft haze tranquilizes the bees. Instead of pinging her with their indignant bodies, the sedate bees allow her to crack the hive's roof, remove its lid, and pull out the wooden frames that scaffold the bees' wax comb. Hinman moves slowly, working to the rhythm of the thousand of insects she tends. Being in a hive engages all your senses, she says. The scents, the sounds, the visuals, it's an immersive practice. Sometimes she goes frame by frame, checking to be sure there are plenty of pearl-white eggs and larvae, called brood, and pollen packed in each cell. Other times she removes wax-capped honey-laden frames to take home to eat or share with other hives in need. Hinman likes honey as much as her hive's tenants do, but for her, the honey is a treat. For her bees, it's essential to their survival. They will protect it with their lives. When a worker honeybee stings to defend her colony, unlike almost any other bee species, her barbed stinger snags skin like a fishhook, ripping the stinger, muscles, and venom from the bee. Now defenseless and broken, the bee soon dies. Hinman knows this, and she knows that one way to prevent her bees from stinging is to keep them calm. So she moves deliberately, mindfully, and smokes them when she needs to. The first version of the modern bee smoker was designed by a man named Moses Quinby in the late 1800s to blow gentle, warm clouds on kept bees in man-made hives. But we humans have been smoking bees since before the written language. Paintings smeared onto cave walls more than 10,000 years ago show us climbing a ladder up to a bee tree. Hopeful and ready, bees swarming all around. Ancient Egyptians, who burned incense as offerings to their honeybees, likely observed the calming quality of its smoke. Before them, we built campfires beneath wild hives and carried smoldering torches as we crept up the trees to raid the hives for honey. Without understanding why, we sensed that smoke would relax our bees. It would help them invite us into their home. Today, we know that the smoke blankets bees' senses. Within a colony, bees use a chemical called pheromones to talk to each other, and smoke interferes with their conversations. It masks the alarm pheromone, Hinman says. For bees, it's like trying to talk in a crowded room. Instead of panicking at the sight of a keeper cracking open their house, bees slow down. They focus on their jobs. Wild honeybees have a complex relationship with smoke and fire. They live in tree cavities, and their houses are essentially tinder, exposed to lightning strikes and wildfires. But those houses are only shells that hold their homes, waxen sheets filled with young bees and ripening honey. If their houses turn to ashes in a blaze, honeybees can easily reconstruct their homes if they still have their queen and their honey. So, when a bee smells a lot of smoke, they instinctively prepare to rebuild, filling their bellies with honey just in case. Like the bees Hinman cares for, most North Carolina bees don't live in trees. Instead, they live in hive boxes that we build, packed with exactly measured frames, also made by us. Each frame, a panoply of perfect hexagonal wax cells, each cell a tiny room to ripen honey, to rear young, to hide pollen. We take their honey and in return feed them like puppies when they run out of food in the cold. Though we keep bees in boxes, our honeybees still have a little wildness in them. We build their houses, but inside they make their own homes just as their ancestors did. They fly where they want, pouring from their boxes to fan across the landscape in search of flowers. Even in winter, bees persist. Unlike most insects that die when the weather turns cold or hide quiet and underground, honeybee colonies don't hibernate. To endure the cold in winter and survive hot, dry periods in summer, they thicken nectar into honey, which doesn't spoil. This is their liquid gold, their secret to survival. They get angry with us when we aren't gentle with them. They communicate the same way as their ancestors, so we must speak to them in the same smoky language as our ancestors. 10,000 years ago, a human climbed a narrow ladder to reach a hole in a tree. Today, Alice Hinman climbs her own ladder to reach the roof of a downtown Raleigh building. Both beekeepers hang on to their smoldering flames, their doorbells trailing with them like wraiths. Both colonies of bees whir and quiver when the smoke drifts in, a shivering wave rippling across 50,000 little bodies. Who is it? They ask each other. Both humans send short gusts of smoke into black doorways. It's only me, they say. Quiet now, please. Stay calm. Okay, let's see where we are here. I think at this point we're going to have to... I'm trying to find out how long the next story is. It might be a little too long, so we'll go back to the beginning. I don't know how much you like the quizzes that we have in our state magazine, but that takes just about the amount of time that we have left. So let's take a look at the quiz. It's about barbecue, says Stuck on Q. In North Carolina, our love affair with pork is undeniable and everlasting. Of course, the first thing I have to do is look up the answer page because I won't know the answers. Number one, the North Carolina Barbecue Society was established in 2006 to promote one of our favorite foods. Headquartered in Winston-Salem, this organization created What Guide to Notable Barbecue Restaurants in Our State, the Historic Barbecue Trail, North Carolina Barbecue Atlas, or the Barbecue Almanac. And the answer is the Historic Barbecue Trail. Politics and barbecue go hand in hand here. Mallard Creek Presbyterian Church's annual barbecue, which began in 1929, allows political candidates to meet voters on the fourth Thursday in October. The church and event are located on Mallard Creek Road near what city? Would that be Asheville, Charlotte, or Hendersonville? And the answer would be Charlotte. The part of the state where barbecue is served often determines what type of sauce is used. Eastern-style sauce includes vinegar and pepper, while Lexington-style sauce is flavored with what ingredient? Mustard, Texas Pete, or ketchup? The answer is ketchup. Number four, Eastern and Lexington styles also differ when it comes to the cut of pork used. Eastern style barbecue uses the whole hog, while Lexington version favors what part of the pig? The ham, shoulder, or chop? And the answer would be shoulder. North Carolina barbecue is traditionally cooked using wood or charcoal, though some places cook with gas or electricity. The most popular types of wood for cooking barbecue in our state are oak and what other species? Hickory, apple, or mesquite? And that's one I actually knew the answer to, and that would be hickory. One of the biggest barbecue celebrations in the country takes place each October in Lexington, bringing tens of thousands of barbecue lovers to town. The event was started in 1984 by Joe Sink, Jr., who was the publisher of what Lexington newspaper? The Observer, the Banner, or the Dispatch? And he was the publisher of the Dispatch. Stamey's Barbecue was founded in 1930 by C. Warner Stamey, who first sold his pit-cooked pork to folks in Shelby and Lexington. In 1953, Stamey opened a drive-in on what is now Westgate City Boulevard in what city? Greensboro, Salisbury, or Spencer? And that would be in Greensboro. In the 1920s, Bob Melton turned his takeout joint into North Carolina's first sit-down barbecue restaurant near the Tar River in what town? Tarboro, Rocky Mount, or Wilson? And that would be Rocky Mount. And finally, the Skylight Inn in Aden has been serving barbecue since 1947. This restaurant is easily recognized by a feature on its roof, which is shaped like what famous structure in Washington, D.C.? The U.S. Capitol, Washington Monument, or the Lincoln Memorial? And the answer? The U.S. Capitol. There's a picture of a skier on the next page. He's got a deer in the headlights look on his face. He's got skis in one hand and poles in the other. He's right in the edge of a drop-off, and it says, "We'll teach you the difference between pizza and French fries. If donuts are your thing, we'll also have snow tubing. Boone, North Carolina, it's better in Boone. There's no place, no better place if you want to learn to ski, but sometimes you just need to flop on an inner tube and let gravity do all the work. We get that. ExploreBoone.com. And Ethan Allen Furniture has an advertisement on the next page, and Bright Moore of South Charlotte says traditional elegance near the Ballantine area. And BiltmoreWines.com would like you to come visit, buy some wine, and enjoy it over the holidays. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine and this month's issue. Hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time as we start into the December issue. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's Reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions? Call us studios, please, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.